Well, I call your attention this evening to the Gospel of Luke 18. Luke chapter 18. In Luke chapter 11, verse number 1, the disciples had asked the Lord to teach them to pray. And later on, as Jesus was instructing them, he said that we are to ask, we are to seek, we are to knock. And the way that is constructed, it is we are to keep on asking and to keep on seeking and to keep on knocking. The parable that we have tonight is an addition to that teaching that he gave them seven chapters ago. Now, as we look at verse number 1, we see the main point of the parable. And he spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. April, this year, prayer and fasting month, always to pray. Every day, I'm not talking about just for your breakfast. I'm not talking about just for your lunch, not just for your snack at 9 o'clock at night. I'm talking about a constant awareness. Now, I want you to look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 17. Pray without ceasing. How can you do that? I mean, don't you have to work every once in a while? Don't you have to deal with customers? Don't you have to deal if you are in a setting with children? I know that that Miss Elizabeth, she's a teacher. Sometimes you have to deal with not just office workers, but like common laborers that are in your group. You may work construction. I mean, you have conversations that you have with other people. Well, how can you pray without ceasing and do that? Well, it has the idea not of going to a monastery. And every time I hear the word monastery, there's a phrase that or a story that goes to my mind. There was a guy that wanted to join the monastery because he wanted to get closer to God. And so they said, so you want to join here? And he said, I do. And they said, okay, we're going to let you join, but you can't say anything for a year. And at the end of 1 year, you get to say two things. He said, okay. 12 months go by. He hasn't said anything. He's standing there before the Monsignor. And he says, okay, what are your two words? He said, food cold. He said, okay, you've got another year of silence, and at the end of the year, you got two words. So 12 more months passed, standing there before the Monsignor again. What are your two words? Bed hard. He said, all right, you've got 12 more months, and then we'll give you two more words. 12 more months go by and said, what are your two words for this year? He said, I quit. And the Monsignor looked at him and said, well, I'm not surprised. All you've done is complain since you've been here. And so when I think of a monastery, that's what I think about. I think of a bunch of monks walking around in their robes and in their little sandals and chanting and, you know, doing their morning and evening prayers, that type of thing. That's not what Paul has in mind. The idea is that it's a constant state of thinking about the Lord. Now, if you look at your paper, you'll see that there are two words, coram Deo. What that is a Latin phrase. It's a phrase that I came across many, many years ago. And basically, this is what it means. It means before the face of God or in the presence of God. So when these Christians in, you know, those churches 500 years ago, when they were speaking Latin and they would use the phrase Coram Deo, what they meant by that was that God was always watching them, and their actions and their words were always before the face of God. God was always present. And that is something that I have always tried to tell my kids. It's something that I've had to learn myself, is that I am always being watched by the Lord. Does not the psalmist say that the eyes of the Lord go to and fro throughout the whole earth? God sees everything that we do. He hears everything that we say. And so when we are praying without ceasing, we are always before the presence of God, keeping our prayers sometimes short, sometimes quick and urgent. How many times have we got a phone call and it be tragic news on the end? Somebody has been in a wreck, somebody's gone to a hospital, and what do? We stop immediately and we whisper a prayer for that situation. I've done that 1,000 times in the last 48 years. And I'm telling you, it is something that just, it gets you quick. And that is what living before the presence of God, it is a quick thing. Years ago, I heard about a missionary that was in Africa. And he was walking through a jungle. And as he was walking, all of a sudden he glanced and there was a huge tiger that was up above him. And he was jumping. And all the missionary could say was, "Help me." And before the tiger hit him, the tiger dropped dead. And I'm like, that's a quick answer to prayer. That's all I'm thinking. But that's how quick it's supposed to be. When we are before the presence of God, that means that we're always thinking about the Lord. I think that you can pray while you're driving. I think you can pray while you're cooking. I think you can pray while you're cutting grass. I think you can pray while you're doing anything. Why? Because we are always mindful of the fact that we are before God's face. And so that is what that means. Now, if you look at this again, pray without ceasing. The word ceasing there is a military word. It is a word that has the idea of attacking, retreating, resting, attacking again, retreating, and attacking again. And it's the way that maybe a military battle would be fought. I know that's the way that inferior numerical forces fight against superior numerical forces. They have to be quick. They have to be agile. They hit, they retreat. They can't just go in there and just start slugging it out. They don't have the numbers to do that. And so they do it quickly. They do it stealthily. They just hit, retreat, hit, retreat. And our prayers are sometimes, "Lord, help us. Lord, we need that." Talking to your coworker, "Lord, I need you to help me. I better go get those green beans off the stove," that type of thing. And so we are constantly understanding that we're before the face of God, and it's a military word, and we just do it continually, back and forth, again and again. If you read our text again, beginning in verse number 1, it says, "Also that men might always to pray and not faint." So if it says not faint, does that not mean that there's a danger that we could faint? It absolutely means that. And I believe that you understand that. You're a Wednesday night crowd. You're not a novice by any stretch of the imagination. If you've been around a minute, you know that there is a danger in our own prayer lives to really want to give up. You say, "Why is that?" Because if we pray about something and pray about something and pray about something and God doesn't answer it quickly, and well, I mean, we live in a microwave age. If God doesn't answer it quickly, it's like, well, is it really going to happen? Now, how many years has it been since the Lord went back to heaven and promised that he was coming again? roughly 2,000 years. 2,000 years. But you know, that's what the world says. But it'd be an awful thing if we maybe didn't say it with our lips, but we think it constantly in our minds. I want you to look with me at 2 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse number 1. We'll go through verse number 5. This second epistle, beloved, I write now unto you, in both which I stir up your pure minds by the way of remembrance, that you may be mindful. Don't forget what the Lord has said here, mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water. We'll not read any farther, but if you were to keep reading, it's talking about the flood that came during Noah's time. What happened? God said, Noah, I want you to build an ark. He began to build. People began to say, what are you doing? I'm building an ark. Why? There's a flood coming. What's a flood? Well, water. What do you mean water? Well, it's going to start raining, and it's going to rain 40 days and 40 nights. What's rain? They had no idea what that was. And he worked on that thing for, I think it was 120 years. And every day he worked on that thing. They would say, what are you doing today? I'm going to work on the boat. And I mean for a century plus, a century and a score, he worked on that boat. And then finally he got it completed. It was pitched inside. It was pitched outside. It was waterproof. All the animals had come. God had sent them to go on that ark. And he put his boys in there. He put their wives in there. He put him and his wife in there. And God shut that door. And all of a sudden, something that had been promised but had never happened, all of a sudden, it happened. That is the example that Peter gives to us about the Lord coming back. And so, it's been 2,000 years. He hasn't come. All that simply means is, it's just closer than it's ever been. That's all that means. And so, we've got to be willing to remember that just because God doesn't operate in our time frame doesn't mean that he's not right on time. Let me ask you a question. When you first got saved, let me just do it this way. Miss Carolyn, how long have you and Brother Billy supported missionaries? That's the year I got saved. That's been almost 54 years ago for me. That's a minute. For over 5 decades, when Brother Billy was living, they gave to missions. We very seldom ever had a missionary that came through here that they didn't do something for that missionary. They give to missions every single week of the world or every month of the world. Have those missionaries that they've supported, and you've supported, and I've supported, have they won 8 billion people to Christ? They have not. As far as I know, the countries that are Muslim, such as Iran, there are Bibles that are going in and out of that place constantly. Dear friend of mine, and I think he's gotten to be a friend with the LaBarbers, a friend named Marty. Marty is involved with a ministry that takes Iranian Bibles into that country. They have to smuggle them in. As far as I know, that place is still run by terrorists. You say, you think they're terrorists? Well, let me ask you this. When you're willing to mow down 40,000 of your own people, do you not think that's terrorism? That's what happened a month ago in Iran. What about Nigeria? At one time, there was a huge, huge influence of Christianity in Nigeria. But on Palm Sunday, last Sunday weekend, there were 10 Christians that were beheaded in Nigeria. Have we won the world to Christ? No, but you know what we do? We keep supporting missions. We keep sending missionaries. We keep doing what we're supposed to do, and we are a constant people that are always praying, and that's the point of this parable. Now, what is the parable? Point number two. We are introduced to two people. Verse number two. It says, there was in a city a judge. Does not give us the judge's name. This judge feared not God. God was not on his mind. It says, neither regarded man. He didn't even respect man. So in other words, he had no fear of God. He had no fear of people. He just did what he wanted to do. Sometimes you have judges that want to act that way. We have judges today that if the president's for it, they're against it. That's just the bottom line. Doesn't have anything to do with law. It has to do with personalities. Shouldn't be that way, but we have that. And so, who is this judge? Well, he's unnamed, but we know his character. Now, in ancient Israel, there were two types of judges that the people thought about. Number one was an orthodox judge. This judge was someone that wanted to judge rightly. Now, you got to remember that in these ancient times, there would be people that would come and they would say, the law of Moses says this, will you make him do what he's supposed to do? And a just judge would follow the Mosaic law. It was not just religious, but it was also civic. That's what was the rule. It was the standard in ancient Israel. But something had happened when Israel had been conquered. Now, in Babylon, they were taken into captivity. All of the choice people like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Later on, you had people like Ezra that was born in captivity. But ultimately, God let Cyrus, who was a Persian, send people back that wanted to go back. Now, there were tens of thousands that said, no, we like it here. We just want to stay. But there were a bunch of them that went back. Well, when they got back, they were still ultimately under the authority of the Persians. And when they fell, they were under the authority of the Greeks. When Alexander the Great began to, quote, Hellenize the known world there in the Middle East, the Hellenization, that is what gave birth to the Greek translation of the Old Testament called the Septuagint. And so the Hellenization had to do with Greek culture, but it was in Israel's lands. And there was people who didn't like that. And because of that, the Pharisees were born. They were the strict, legalist, letter of the law type people. Well, the Greeks still were the boss until the Romans came along, and then the Romans became the boss. So, in Israel, you had a judge that could be an Orthodox judge, or during the time of the Romans, either the Roman government or Herod, who was a placeholder for the Roman government, would appoint judges, and it was much like a tax collector being appointed. Do you remember how many times the Pharisees and the Sadducees would say something like this? He eats with publicans and sinners. It has the idea of he's eating with a tax collector. That guy's working for the Romans. He's trying to cheat us. And they hated tax collectors, and they hated these judges. Now, I didn't write it out, but there's actually a word that was being used by these people. And the meaning of the word, it was kind of a play on words about, oh, he's a judge. Well, the play on the word was, he was a robber judge. In other words, if you had money to buy him a meal, he might rule in your favor. But if you didn't have anything, man, you are just out of luck. Ivor Powell said this. He said there were scoundrels. Such judges were notorious. And unless the plaintiff had money or influence to bribe the judge, he had little hope of receiving justice in his case. The people had a name for that type, robber judges. And Ivor Powell got that from Thayer, who is another commentator. And so he didn't fear God. He didn't respect man. He basically operated the way that he wanted to. That's my courtroom. I will do what I want to do. I don't care what you think. But behind the scenes, give me some money. But there's a second person in this parable. That is the widow lady. Look at verse number 3. And there was a widow in that city. And she came unto him, saying, avenge me of mine adversary. Now, we know that widows were often abused. Now, we don't know what the abuse is. It's speculation on our part. But there are four things that I wrote down, and we'll look at these. Sometimes widows would be oppressed. Look at Malachi chapter 3 and verse 15. And now we call the proud happy. Yea, they that work wickedness are set up. Yea, they that tempt God are even delivered. And I wrote down the wrong thing. What does verse 5 look like? We see that. I think it's chapter 3 that talks about widows' houses. Take my word for it. It's in Malachi. Let's go to a second verse, all right? Exodus 22. Exodus 22, verse 22 through 24. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, in any way, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. In other words, if you oppress, if you take advantage of a widow, then I'm going to hammer you. That's basically what God's saying. I really believe that there are three reasons why that God has kept his good hand of blessing upon this church. I believe that it's because of our mission program. God knows that we have tried to love missionaries as long as I've been here, because Brother Don was here before me and he loved missionaries dearly. As far as I know, Brother Pittard loved missionaries, but Brother Don's the one that put the missionaries on the map as far as the number that we have. But we love missionaries at this place. Number two, when I took over about 9 years ago, June will be 9 years, we began to focus on two things, and it all stemmed from me preaching through the book of James. And at the end of chapter 1, it said that pure religion and undefiled is to visit the fatherless and the widows. And we began a widows and an orphans emphasis at our church. And I believe that the missions and the widows and the orphans, those three things, I believe that that is why God keeps his good hand of blessing upon this place. I really believe that. And so you've got God saying, I will kill you with the sword if you take advantage of them. Look at Isaiah chapter 1, verse 17. Learn to do well. Seek judgment. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Plead for the widow. The word judge for the fatherless has the idea of giving justice to the fatherless. In other words, they don't have the ability to hire high-priced attorneys. But if you're a judge, you're supposed to do right. Much like Romans 13 talks about that the police are put there to wield the sword, but they are supposed to do it as ministers of God for good. That's why every time I hear about some cop that is a bad cop, all I'm thinking is, you can answer to God for that. But then you hear about 1,000 guys that try to help people, and I'm thinking, you'll answer to God for that, and he'll give you an attaboy. And so you've got Isaiah, and he says, you take care of them legally. And then one that's in Luke chapter 20 in the New Testament, he talks about those which devour widows' houses and for a show make long prayers. And it says that the same, those hypocrites, shall receive a greater damnation or a greater judgment. And so you have this widow woman, and she comes and she has an ought against somebody that has been her enemy. I don't know if somebody took the little home that she had. I don't know if some financial advisor hoodooed her out of the money that maybe her husband had left her. I don't know how she gets to this judge, but he is the authority that she has to deal with, and he does not have time for her. He's not giving her the time of day. But she wouldn't stop coming. Now, I mean, there are times when it's just like, they won't hush. They got to be quiet. This woman was not accepting that. I heard something the other day about when Chuck Norris died, said he told a woman to hush and she did. If you don't know who Chuck Norris is, he's the guy that, you know, supposedly the tough guy and all of that. But I'm telling you, whenever this lady decided, you know what, I will just keep on asking and asking and I'll keep coming back. I will appeal it. I will appeal it. I will appeal it. And he didn't really want to do anything for her. There was no money that she could give him. There was absolutely nothing that she had that would have been a temptation for him to say, well, give me that and I will take it. He just didn't want to be bothered, but it says that she just said, basically, that she was just gonna keep on. If you read with me, it says in verse number 4, and he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God and don't regard man, yet because this widow troubleth me. The word troubleth there, it has the idea that she keeps coming back and just hitting me with this lawsuit and hitting me with this case and wanting me to judge in her way. And it literally is to the point to where the word has the idea she's giving me a black eye. It would be as though somebody would come by and just pop him, and next thing you know, his eyes turn black. And she comes back and she pops him again. There are some commentators that think that this woman really was about to attack him because she would not take no for an answer. And it says, I will avenge her. I am going to do this. Why? Because she is wearing me out. I mean, she just will not give up. You may tell you who it reminds me of. It reminds me of my Allison. When she gets something on her mind, that's all that matters in the whole world. It may be 6 months from now, but if it's on her mind, that means it's on everybody's mind. And I mean, it's just every day. Now, Dad, you got to take care of this. Allison, it's 3 months away. I know, but I don't want you to forget. I know it's 2 months away, but I don't want you to forget. And I mean, she is a bulldog. This woman is a bulldog. And she just keeps coming back, and she is wearying him. And finally, he says, you know what? I am going to avenge her. I'm going to listen to her case, and I'm going to make a judgment for her. Why? I don't care if it's right or wrong. I'm tired of her coming and bothering me. I'm tired of her walking home after me saying, I need you to help me. I'm tired of her standing outside of the restaurant. I need you to help me. She will not leave him alone. And so he avenges her. Now the third thing. Look at verse number 6. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust saith. Verse 7. And shall not God avenge his own elect? Now, let me stop right there for a moment. I don't want you to think that Jesus is comparing this unjust judge, the man that had no respect for anybody. I don't want you to think that he is making the comparison or conflating him with God. It's actually a contrast. It is 180 degrees from what this man is like. God is totally different than that. And so I want us to remember that God cares about everything that we have going on. Now, I want you to look with me at Psalm 103, verse 13. Like as a father pitieth his children. Now, the word pitieth there doesn't always mean just to feel sorry for. It has the idea of showing favor. So as a father shows favor to his children, so the Lord shows favor to them that fear him. Look with me at Isaiah 49, 14 through 16. But Zion said, now what is Zion? Zion is like the old city that Jerusalem sat on. It's a hill, Zion's hill, and the old city there. And it says, but Zion said, the Lord hath forsaken me and my Lord hath forgotten me. Can a woman forget her suckling child that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yea, they may forget, but I will not forget thee. Behold, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me. The people of Zion were going, God has forgotten about us. And God goes, no, I haven't. I have not forgotten. Can a woman that has just given birth and she has a little baby that is nursing on one of her breasts, can she forget that baby? No. He says, I've got your names engraved on the palms of my hands. Now you know that is figurative language. God doesn't have palms, all right, on his hands. God doesn't have hands. God is a spirit. But they understand that little metaphor there, that it's as though you had a father that was a human father and etched on his hands, every time he looked at it, would be the name of his kids. Years ago, when we had three grandkids at the time, now we have five. I was looking on the internet, and what do you buy a woman that's got everything? My wife's got everything. She got me and the Lord. But I'm looking to see what I can get her. It was either for Christmas or for her birthday. And all of a sudden, I see this little piece of jewelry. And I'm thinking, that looks good. And for $99, you could get three birthstones in that little necklace. So I thought, okay, that's good. So I looked up the stones that were corresponding to the three older grandkids, which would have been Carter, Libs, and Iz. And I ordered that thing, and I kept thinking, it's got to get here. It's got to get here. Well, it finally got there, and I'm visualizing something about this big. That's what I'm visualizing, something that she can put around her neck, and when she walks in, everybody in church is going to go, man, that is a nice looking necklace and brooch there. That thing come back and it was about the size of my little fingernail. Now there was three stones on it, and I'm looking, I had a hard time even seeing it with my glasses on. And I looked at that and I'm thinking, she's going to have to explain this every time somebody asks her about it. I mean, it even had like their names like etched on it. That's how small it was. Here, it's as though you have it in letters where that he looks and he sees there's those names, the names of his people. And even has the walls around that city that are continually before him. They are Coram Deo before him. They were before his very face in his presence. That is the way God is with us. He is always watching us. Everything that we do, he knows. If he knows about sparrows that hop along the ground, and he knows how many hairs are on your head, he knows everything there is to know about you and me. And we need to remember that God cares deeply about us. One final verse and then we'll close. Look at 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse number 6, and we'll read 6 and 7. Humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. That's a million miles from an unjust judge that doesn't respect anybody or anything. God created us in his image. He saved us by his son. He loves us, and he wants to answer our prayers when we come. Now, remember the point? The point is that we ought to always to pray and not to faint. Now, what are some final thoughts? God doesn't delay his answers because he lacks the power to answer them. Let that sink in for a moment. There is nothing that God cannot do if he wants to do it. He is omnipotent. He is all power. When he spoke the world into existence, there was nothing. There was no raw materials. When you read where it says, and God said, let there, and he created, that means he created, the Hebrew word is ex nihilo. It means out of nothing. Now, you build a house, you got to have some 2x6s, and you got to have some 2x8s, and some 2x4s, and you got to have some plywood, and you got to have some shingles, and you got to have some pipes for plumbing, and you got to have all kind of stuff. God didn't have any of that. He spoke it into existence, and it was. He's got the power to do anything that he chooses to do. And so when we don't get that answer, it's not because he lacks the power to do it. Second of all, God often delays because it is for our good. I have lived long enough to know that things that I have wanted and did not get turned out to be a bigger blessing than I would have gotten had I got what I had asked for. And I hope I said that just right. In other words, sometimes you don't get what you really want because you don't really want it. You just don't know it yet. But you will learn that through time, through growth, through growing in Christ. You'll look back and go, I thank God that he did not give me what I had asked for. And I have seen God do that in my own life many, many, many times over. And so we still trust, though, during those times. God doesn't look at time as we do. I mean, it's been 2,000 years since the Lord said, and if I go and prepare a place, I will come again. Okay. 2,000 years. I mean, what are we promised? 70? And if by reason of, you know, blessings, we get, you know, 80. And by big blessings, we get 97 like Miss Sarah, 98 like Brother Ray Ash, who just got dressed for breakfast and sat down in his chair and went to be with the Lord. I mean, pretty good way to go at 98. And so you've got these blessings of the Lord, but God doesn't look at time like we do. I mean, if you made it to 100, What's 100 in comparison to 2,000? Look at the verse up on the screen, 2 Peter 3:8. But beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years. Now, it did not say it was 1,000 years. It says as 1,000 years. And 1,000 years as one day. God is not bound by time the way that you and I are bound by time. Now, we think in terms of birthday parties, and we think in terms of New Year's, and we think in terms of what the calendar tells us to do that day. But with God, 2026 is just as current as 1776 or 2326. God is not bound by time the way that we are. He doesn't think in terms, man, that is forever. He's not like children and think, oh, Christmas is never going to get here. And we as parents going, Christmas comes too much. And so God is not bound by that time the way that we are. Now, if we go back to our last verse, verse number 8. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? Well, I think that we can probably answer that, yeah. There's going to always be a remnant of people that have faith. But there's also going to be an apostatizing that takes place. An apostate is a person who at one time claimed to adhere to the principles and to the beliefs and to the doctrines of Christianity. At one time, they confessed that they believed that Jesus was the Christ. At one time, they confessed that they believed that the Bible was the Word of God. At one time, they believed that the blood of Christ was our way of salvation, being saved by him shedding his blood and dying on the cross. They believed that. But yet they turned their back on that. So how are we to look at that? Did they get saved and lose their salvation? No, I think there's too many eternal security verses for that. I think the way that you have to look at it is they were like the seed in Matthew chapter 13. The seed was sown everywhere, and you had some that was by the wayside, and when it began to maybe pop through a little bit, all of a sudden the birds descended upon it, and it began to pluck those seeds and eat those seeds. Boom, gone. Then there was some seeds that had fallen among the thorns and the thistles. And they began to come up, but the thorns and the thistles were already mature. And so they began to eat the nutrients, and before long, the seeds died out. Or there was also some on stony ground. And they also had no root, and they died out. But there was 25%, one quarter of the seeds that were sown ended up on good ground. I didn't write this down, but if you want to jot this down, Karen, if you can, go to a verse in 1 John. I want you to go to 1 John chapter 2. Let's try verse 19. I think that's it. And I'll give this to you, and I think that this is the way that you have to look at those that have apostatized, and we are living in days of apostasy, no doubt about it. They went out from us. In other words, at one time, they had congregated in the congregation with the church. But they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have no doubt have continued with us. But they went out that they might be made manifest, that they might be made known, that they were not all of us. In other words, we have had people that have come and they have joined this church. I'm thinking right now of two guys that came in, and I mean, it was bam, bam, bam. They were all on fire for the Lord. I mean, they were here. I mean, every service, and that lasted for about a month, and the next thing you know, nobody can find him. I mean, and this has been the last year. And I'm like, did they die and the family not call us? I mean, we have no way to know. And I mean, I could rattle their names off right now. I won't do it because I don't want to embarrass them if they, you know, have had some kind of malady that we're not aware of. But all I'm thinking is, how many times have you had people that you know, and I mean, they come in, and I mean, it's just gangbusters. But all of a sudden, you look up, and they're not a part of it anymore. Maybe the preacher says something hard one day. Well, I don't like that, and I ain't going back. Maybe your deacon talks to them one day, and they go, I don't like what that deacon said. Maybe it's just somebody that sat in their seat one day. You know? I mean, used to, 200 years ago, people bought their pews. And I mean, if they didn't want somebody to sit there, that's my pew. I bought that pew. Get out of that pew. Now, we don't subscribe to that. But let me ask you this. Have you ever seen in a church little name tags on the end of pews? This pew was purchased by Tom and Deb Foskey. Well, you know why these don't have name tags on them, even though some of them might have been purchased? Is because you get there, you can sit there. There was a lady named Sally at the church that I was saved at down in Savannah. And Sally was different. We would say she's touched. Sally would come in no matter what Sunday of the year it was, and this is what she had on. She had on a red slicker hat, just like you would wear in the rain. She had on a red slicker rain jacket. She had on a red dress. She had on red stockings. She had on red shoes. She had a red purse, and she had a red umbrella. And she sat on about the second row right in the middle. One Sunday morning, there's about 1,500 people that's coming in to sit down in that morning service. And there was a visiting couple, and the only place that they found was the second row. Now, a lot of people, you know, back then, you know, they would get there early so they could get a back seat. But these people didn't have a choice, so they had to sit down toward the front. And so the whole pew was open there. So they're sitting there right on the end, and Sally comes walking down, and she's got that red hat, that red coat, that red dress, those red hose, those red shoes, that red umbrella, and she's just looking, and she just stands, don't say a word. She just stares. And finally, the man looks up and goes, is this your seat? She goes, okay. And so him and his wife just slid right on down. That was her seat. We don't have seats. And so, now, I must admit this, I look for you in certain places. And if I don't see you, I'm going, oh, they're not here today. They must be either sick or out of town. Hopefully they can just lay out. But the point is that there are people that join churches, but they're really not part of it. I tell people often, you can tell us two lies and become a member of this church. All you got to do is lie and tell me that you've been saved, and lie and tell me you've been baptized by immersion, and we'll say, hey, come on in, brother. Come on in, sister. When in reality, you may have lied to me about both those things. I don't know it. But I know this. I know that there's going to be a group of people that'll be faithful to God, and I want us to be a part of that. I think of churches constantly. I saw something, I commented on it to Deb, that every week in America, 12 churches close. That's awful. That is awful. But if God doesn't keep his good hand of protection, that number could increase. It could absolutely increase.